Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson. I'm your host for today. Well, I'm delighted to be speaking on the phone with Darrell Hamilton. He is the author of a satirical and humorous novel titled The Call. The book chronicles the events that lead the main character to seek out seminary as a means of attaining purification. Darrell throws in supernatural religion and familiar dysfunction, creating a well-accepted read. But before we talk to Darrell, I'd like to know a little about him. Darrell Hamilton was born in Santa Cruz, California. After graduating from community college, Darrell transferred to UC Davis, where he majored in American Studies and became active in the Campus Christian program. During the time he was active in that program, he received what he interpreted as a call to ministry. He then enrolled in the Phillips Graduate Theological Seminary in pursuit of the Master's of Divinity degree. A few years later, Darrell pursued a master's degree in library science. He earned the degree but found library jobs to be quite scarce, so he took an administrative support job, this time with the Santa Clara Valley Transit Authority, where he's been for the past 26 years. Darrell continued freelance writing. At the age of 40, decided he had done enough living to lend credibility to fiction writing. He has since been able to have four of his short stories published, along with nonfiction articles. And he also brought his first novel to print, which we're going to be talking about today, The Call. Darrell still lives in the Bay Area of Northern California and enjoys playing his banjo in bluegrass and old-time jam sessions. Hi, Darrell.
Hello.
Well, this is a real pleasure to talk to you. You do have a very interesting book. I know anybody has read it that's really... found it quite interesting and enjoyable. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the concepts that are in your book but really relate to society, and one of them is religion.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that you mentioned at some point here, I heard you say that religion as a theater. And I'd just like to kind of have you expand that a little bit.
Okay, well, that was originally given to us by this one... professor named by the name of William Bryan. That's who I patterned the character Brian Wilson at, because a lot of what he said was in the classroom. A minister is basically an actor, and many people who do not cut it in the ministry often go into acting, and one of the people that most readily comes to mind is Marjo Gortner. Remember him?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Yes.
Tell me more.
I remember one time he was on the Johnny Carson show. He said he could lead the people in sing-along with the drop of a hat. Sure shooting. He put on his ministerial guise, and even though it was a rather secular audience, he had them clapping along and caught up in the charismatic flair of the moment. So... acting is something that's an integral part, supposedly, of the profession. And this dates back to the time of the ancient Greeks, where theater was a form of worship. The worship, of course, was to the god of wine and frivolity, Dionysus. And like Jesus, they both turned the water into wine. And usually they had plays. They were either... darkly tragic or comedy. Everyone in the city-state attended. It was generally once a month, and generally the teachings were couched within the play that were of science and morality, that were the concepts of science and morality, that is, that were prevalent during that period of time. And well, the theater concept is carried through even to today's services. Oftentimes, they have enactments of various plays. I remember one time, Virginia Woolf was an integral part of the service, an excerpt from Virginia Woolf. So theater is very much alive and well, and the minister, priest, or rabbi is the leading thespian in the course of the theater.
You know, Darrell, I'm just kind of smiling as I'm listening to you, because I never thought about it that way, but as I'm listening to what you're saying, You know, that is so true. I mean, the minister or the rabbi or the cleric, whomever is up there, really needs to, like you say, to be very up on acting because and presentation skills and be able to do performances in front of people.
That's right.
I just never gave it any thought, but you are so right, because really, and it seems to me that as I watch some of the charismatic ministers on television, they are very animated, some of them.
And they are, in a very real sense, acting. And what a good actor does is draw you into the theatrics of the moment.
And, you know, that could be positive, and it could also be negative, can't it?
Absolutely. I was going over the Internet a few weeks back, and I saw this article called Mind Control Training.
Uh-huh.
And generally, with charismatics, they can do many things to sell you on the theme of the moment. In fact, my roommate even told me that certain psychologists and psychiatrist right during the time of Obama's campaign said he was using certain mind control techniques. Naturally, Obama is very charismatic, and he can draw you in, and he has. After all, proof is what is situated in the White House right at present. Same is also true with, it's true in politics, it's true in religion, probably true in practically every walk of life, every profession. The people at the top have to utilize this form of charisma to draw people in. But charisma, like you said, there's a negative part to it. Oftentimes, they say charisma is a very dangerous gift to have because people don't hold you accountable. They're so drawn to you and what you exude from yourself. Generally, they give you a pass on a lot of things that they shouldn't give you a pass on, like your inconsistencies and things like that.
Well, you know, again, as I'm listening to it's I'm finding this very stimulating for my mind, Daryl, and I'm really glad I'm talking to you, because this is an area that I hadn't thought about recently. And as you're speaking, I'm really kind of thinking of, you know, you were talking about charismatic, and I'm thinking that sometimes on TV they have, and I just forget the names of them, but the healers, where the people come up and they're just in pain or they can't see or whatever, and, you know, the whomever it is, the healer, the minister, hits the person on the forehead, they fall down and they're immediately healed. Or also the mind control is, you know, asking for money or send in money, because I've read of people that have sent in their last pennies to some evangelist on television to support, because, and to me, I think that's mind control. I don't know if you feel that as well.
Oh, yes, I definitely feel that way. One of the techniques that was alluded to, and I haven't had time to read the entire article on the mind control thing, was the Godfather approach.
Mm-hmm.
The alpha male is exuded, and generally, when there is an alpha male, well, he definitely encourages following. Like, for instance, it is said, as you're developing yourself, and you can develop this probably within yourself, working on your inner game and understanding the secrets of being the alpha, Bay Alpha is really all about becoming someone who people naturally perceive as having high value.
Uh-huh.
This Jack Van Impe, I believe, he was known as the bopper because he bopped you on the head. And yes, he was, I guess he's still alive, highly dynamic in his presentation, and could actually say, okay, you no longer have this affliction. You may have, but you no longer have it. And he's drawn along. The recipient is drawn into belief of this because, well, Jack Van Impe, messenger of God, definitely he has to have high value. And this is powerful mind control technique, because people Well, like I said, they naturally see you as having high value, and they do see you as the alpha personality.
And then I'm wondering, Daryl, too, is there anything wrong with that? I mean, if the people can use their mind to control and dispel an illness, is there anything really wrong with that?
It's a neutral thing.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's like I learned assertiveness training. Okay, that can be used to, say, raise money for a noble charity,
mm-hmm.
or it can be used, as I heard it say, to drive the car for the mafia. It's an amoral type of thing, and the morality, which is connected to it, generally is up to the individual who wields that power or wields that technique. It has, intrinsically, it has no morality of its own. It's the morality that is given to the holder of it. So, yes, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with it.
If it's not used to take advantage of people, definitely.
Right.
Yeah.
So often, though, the dark side
mm-hmm.
is exuded.
Well, then it becomes power and control.
What?
Then it becomes power and control.
Power and control, absolutely.
Yes.
There's a book out. If you go to any Christian bookstore, I'm sure they can see Churches That Abuse. And
yeah.
That is the power and control. Matter of fact, the church I go to, one of the more cultic version of it grafted itself to my church. It was called, I think, the Boston Church of Christ, the San Francisco Church of Christ. These techniques are very readily used.
Mm-hmm.
Like I remember one time, the pastor said, okay, next week everybody wear a red shirt. Well, what possible thing do you plan to gain by wearing a red shirt to church? Absolutely nothing except everybody in unison wears a red shirt. And the minister is saying, see, I can do that. He would be saying that to himself. It also promotes a singleness of mindset instead of respecting one's individuality.
Power and control.
And mind control, absolutely.
Yeah, for sure. Daryl, let's just tell our listeners here about your experience in the seminary. I understand that you were there for some time.
Mm-hmm.
And
it took me 4 years to get through the three-year program because I had to work, too.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And why did you – did you actually complete?
Yes, I did. I got my MDiv.
You do? Did you actually minister?
Well, while I was in seminary, I did some sporadic student ministry work.
Mm-hmm.
The employment I had was secular. But afterwards, I did not go for ordination. They did not feel I was psychologically equipped to bear the brunt of it. And that was an important part of theological training.
Mm-hmm.
The psychological fits into it. We were made to take the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory test. We were told to take, say, a stress test. I make allusions to that in the novel. A number of other tests. In fact, one of the first classes we took, and this is alluded to in the novel, was the Introduction to Theological Education. And the main crux of the class was the interpersonal relation part, where everybody was gathered together in, say, a room, say, placed in a circle, and we were told to interact. And there's nothing like being placed in a group of strangers and being told by the group moderator, care for one another.
Hmm.
It shattered the illusion about we're all Christians, we're all here filled with the love of Jesus, we all should like each other. When actually, the reality of it is, when we got into the crux of group dynamics, some people we actually hated.
Yeah.
That was rather a shattering of ideals. But it's reality. and it's reality that hits hard and fast. And one of the things we have to have a grasp on, if we're to truly succeed in the endeavor of ministry, is a grasp on reality.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. Join us and hear both well-known and upcoming writers talking candidly about their life experience as well as the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, we strive to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are available 24/7 through direct podcast as well as MP3 download for your convenience. Please visit us on InsideScoopLive.com. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with Darrell Hamilton, author of The Call. As you've heard so far, Darrell has some interesting views and thoughts, so stay tuned because there's just so much more. Were you disappointed when you were told that this is not a path for you?
Oh, yes, I was disappointed, although after looking back over years ago, I'm rather certain they were correct.
Mm-hmm. Are you still doing any type of lay ministry?
No, I generally just go to church once a week. I've been involved in certain things, but basically I just am on the periphery of.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now I had contemplated becoming involved after I retired, which I am right now, in a certain ministry that I found to be unique, and that was the pet ministry, where you ministered to bereaved people who have lost their dogs or pet cats, pet hamster, things like that.
Pet ministry is getting to be a big thing.
The what is?
The pet ministry.
It is?
It is.
I just saw it, and
yes.
Well, like in the Catholic Church, they had, and they may still have, I'm not sure, Animal Dedication Sunday, which is commemorated in October near the Feast of St. Augustine, I believe. Now, I might be guilty of giving some misinformation as to.
I think it's St. Francis.
No, wait a minute.
Yeah, St. Francis is the.
You're right. You're right.
The pets and birds and animals and yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. I thought I'm getting my saints mixed up. Sorry, but yes, you're right. And well, somebody told me that I can't remember what they call them, but they're used to keep the animals out of the sanctuary proper when they're brought in.
Mm-hmm.
But great time to go and. Get your animal blessed.
Yes.
And I'm thinking right now of a YouTube presentation I heard, saw this one Jimmy Rogers song called A Little Dog Cry about a dog that was there at the time of the crucifixion. Very moving number.
Mm-hmm.
Jimmy Rogers did that back in 1961. It's a real tearjerker, I tell you.
Well, you know, as I mentioned, that the pet ministry seems to be really exploding, and I think that people are really wanting that, too. In the church that we also go to once a year, there's a pet blessing, but also that they have created a pet memorial garden as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a pet ministry within the church also, where there's a group of people that will minister to those that, you know, are grieving pet loss. And I think it's great because our society, most of us create, you know, pets is part of our family, and when the loss happens, this is big.
Now, there's one, apart from Christianity, I believe, at one point when Zoroastrianism was the big religion, it was considered a home that had a pet. A pet was an exalted part of having a home. They were truly blessed if they had a pet, and they were given an exalted position within the family structure. So it's not exclusive to Christianity.
Oh, no, not at all.
Oh.
Yeah. So, Gerald, what do you think? What's happening in our society right now with religion? What are your views on this?
Not sure. It's kind of a mixed bag.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
I know that Richard and Ryan Olnieber, the two theologians, were used to address that issue. They had a Christ with the culture, Christ against culture, Christ and culture. What's happening with religion? What I've experienced is that the closer the positive, the more the positive, the more the negative comes about. If you ever go to pro-life or pro-life versus pro-choice rally, you see both sides coming in full force. And it can be a frightening thing to behold at times, at least I found,
mm-hmm.
found it to be such. No quarter is given on either end. Like true pagan roots tend to take place. I know the pro-choicers used to garb themselves in makeup similar to the Celts as they went to do battle. Meanwhile, the pro-lifers are there as the stoic Bible readers in a circle. Well, alluding back to our first topic, it's a theatrical demonstration.
Yeah.
In the truest sense. And, well, oftentimes society is an extension of that theater. I used to listen to a lot of talk radio, and they, the way they describe political events, that's all theater as well. I think they already know who's going to be, say, the Republican nominee, but it's just a matter of positioning things in strategical and theatrical, and the theatrical mode to get him in there. Yeah, I'm getting away from the topic, though. I'm sorry.
Well, it all is interesting that, you know, theatrics really plays in a lot of different areas, as you say, politics, but not only that, but in religion also. And, you know, when we really would stop and think about it, it's in many, many other aspects as well. And, gosh, this has been really interesting talking to you, Gerald. And I just want you to sort of briefly describe the sort of a brief synopsis of your book, The Call, so that our listeners, after listening to what you have to say, sort of can, you know, see what your book is about and how it relates to what we just spoke about.
Okay. I call it combining the satire and the supernatural. Now, I did not originally, a lot of emphasis was placed on the satirical aspect, but I'm not the one who originally labeled it a satire. That was done by one of my editors. But it combines the satire and the more horrific version of the supernatural. I have to get a little exorcist in there somewhere. And it utilizes also biblical motif in a kind of a revised form of the Abraham, Isaac, and Ishmael mode. Only in this instance, the supposed hero, Isaac, is taken out of the scene, and only the one that is cast out, the pariah, is left. But throughout the book and throughout the theme is, basically, it comes to the protagonist, Ishmael is not endowed with the attributes necessary to fulfill his family legacy, and ultimately, through necessity, has to be cast out. But it's all about the pariah and the usurper taking hold of what was originally meant for his brother, while his brother inhabits the soul of my protagonist.
So, Gerald, how much of the book is actually based on your own experience?
Oh, well, I've drawn sporadically from my own experience, certain interpersonal interactions and things along those lines, but basically it's it's fiction.
Uh-huh.
And I write generally about what I know to give it believability. I've known many military families, having grown up as one, in one, and I know basically from my own experience and the observation of other experiences how interaction is done, how the father has the ultimate say. One family I knew, whenever they were addressed, or whenever the kids were addressed, they'd always respond with, "Ma'am? Sir?" And having read Pat Conroy's book, The Great Zantini, I could see parallels to mine and
sure.
others. So, although there is similarity, I drew up generally fictitious account of the military family. That's from the first part of my book. Now, the seminary, I actually drew from authentic interactions between the seminarians. Now, some might think it's a bit coarse. There was an elder in my church who said he was sad, and that wasn't at all what it was like in his seminary experience. But I told him, well, this is I came through the Ecumenical Council of Churches type of theological upbringing. My church was a part of it, and yours was not. I made a conversion over to yours. You were raised in it, so naturally there would be some differences that might shock you. He brought it to the minister, and the minister said, yeah, they act like that in certain settings. In fact, it's more common than, say, the what is espoused in the conservative setting. Those little anecdotes that are scattered throughout the book, interpersonal interaction about the doctoral student wanting to go home and drink a can of Budweiser and read his Playboy before he had to embark upon his wife's honey-do list, that's based on actual interpersonal interactions that I took part in or overheard. So that's very true.
Uh-huh.
Satire in many instances mirrors reality. Like, for instance, have you ever read Sinclair Lewis's Babbitt?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Remember that speech he gives?
Uh-huh.
A really long speech about, we're a bunch of businessmen, we're regular guys with our adding machines. You'd use computers now as a substitute. That same speech was given at the Rotary Club in Sacramento back in 1965, and it warranted a standing ovation. And even though I expect that there is going to be quite a few ministerial students who rise up and claim my book to be a damnable lie from a distorted and perverted mind, there is much truth in what is there, and they wouldn't respond so vehemently against it were there not an element of truth. There's an old saying I was given back when I was doing this clinical pastoral education, where transactional analysis was an integral part of the program. Ye shall know the truth. Truth shall make ye mad.
And this is a good place to close this interview off. It's just been a real pleasure talking to you, Daryl. Would you tell our listening audience your website address?
Yes. www.dhamiltonbooks.com.
There you go, listeners. It's dhamiltonbooks.com. Check it out. The name of the book is called The Call, and I'm sure that you're going to thoroughly enjoy it because I know that many readers have. Daryl, thanks again. This has been a real pleasure speaking with you.
Thanks for having me.
And there you go, listeners. Thanks for listening. This is Irene Watson with Inside Scoop Live. Bye for now.